Let me put it in a different context for a moment. I'm sure you know about Schumpeter's famous claim that it's the third decade that is the productive decade in every, his argument is that every scientist, whatever discipline, almost, the really important decade in his work is the third decade, between the ages of 20 and 30. And I think there's an enormous amount of that, to that, except that I've tended to modify it and to say that what's important is the first decade in which he's active in the profession in which he makes his name. For example, Goffredo Pareto was an engineer in his third decade, but his main contributions to economics and sociology date from his first 10 years as an economist and sociologist. And if you take other exceptions of people like Ricardo, who was a stockbroker in his third decade, but who in the first 10 years when he started to work is when he did all his work. And I think in general, that first 10 years period, Alfred Marshall is a perfect example. He really never did a damn thing intellectually beyond the age of about 33 or 4. But in the sense of the basic theoretical structure, it was all completed by then.
I'm going to put it somewhat differently in your case. I would say, yes, as concerns the temperament, your intellectual temperament. That is the way you took your passion for clear, analytical, taxonomic thought, and the way that you combine that with your interest in statistics, your empirical bent. That is, that temperament came together.
No, I think you're right
at that time.
I'm not quarreling with your conclusion, with your initial statement. I do think, whether it's 52, 53, 54, that the major aspects of my thought were pretty well set by then, and that since then, in the last 40 years, it's been a development and an application to different problems. But I'm not so sure, and the question is why? And I'm sure that the answer is a very straightforward one. The University of Chicago was a very intellectually stimulating environment, particularly at that time, the presence there of Knight, Aaron Director, Aaron I'm sure played a large influence, Lloyd Mintz, Henry Simons died, as you know, this is about the time I came. The best batch of graduate students at Chicago, any university ever had because of the return from the war, because of the GI Bill. You had a really remarkable group of graduate students. And it was a very intellectually active and stimulating environment. Now, let's remember that the, from this point of view, that the wartime years from 40, from 39, really from 40, in my case, to 45, were a kind of a digression from a straight path of development. Three of those years I spent at the Treasury Department, and that was in the field of economics. And I did learn a great deal. I'm sure I benefited from that. But one of the things I noted along your line, when I came across, in doing the memoir, when I came across a memo that I had written at the Treasury Department on inflation, it was a straight, I may have said this to you before, it was a straight Keynesian memo.
Yes, I have some of those quotes
here.
In fact, you, I think in your article for the Committee on Economic development, fiscal and monetary policy, you say that the reason the government has to set wages and prices in certain professions is to prevent a cumulative, destructive cumulative deflation. And you said that late in the 40s.
I don't think, did I say that?
Yeah.
But the reason the government has to fix prices? I can't believe it. You're not, when you think of medieval economic development.
Let's see. He said, moreover, the adoption of such a proposal, and this is the where money supply would vary with the deficit, but the deficit would be balanced over the cycle, would provide some assurance against cumulative deflation and thereby tend to make flexibility of prices a good deal easier to achieve, since government support for monopolistic practices of special occupational and industrial groups derives in large measure from the obvious waste of general deflation and the need for protection against it.
Well, I guess that's right. It would make it easier to achieve. See, the difference is, I don't think that sentence says that it's desirable to have those prices. See, there are two different questions, explaining why you have such price fixing and whether it's desirable to have such prices. And I thought you were originally attributing to me the view that it was desirable and that it would in fact serve the purpose of stemming a serious deflation. But that isn't what that says. That says that the reason why you have support for it is because...
Okay.
It's the same thing like the minimum wage, for example. The reason you have support for the minimum wage is the belief that it will help low-income people. But that doesn't mean it's a valid belief. And I think if you read that sentence over again, you see it doesn't say, it doesn't endorse the idea that fixing those prices will in fact stem a deflation.
Okay. Look, that's kind of a digression. Let me come back to the other main point. In terms of your intellectual temperament. The first time you state what I think of as the methodology of the Chicago School is in the Marshallian demand curve, and you've got a great line.
That's the first place I think it's published, but unpublished memorandum. I had written an early version. That was published, what, 48, 50?
49.
As early as 47, early 47 or 46, I had written the first draft of what all of them was the article on methodology. And so, the views expressed in them, it may be that that's the first place where they're published, is in the Marchetti Demand Curve. But the actual development of them occurred in 1946 and 47.
When did you go to Chicago?
46.
I see. So it was upon...
I went in September 46. Mm-hmm. And sometime during... The reason I know this, the reason I'm thorough, is because I looked into it for a special reason. In 1947, I attended the first meeting of the Montpelier Society. Mm-hmm. And one of the people who was there was Karl Popper.
Yeah, he recently died, yeah.
Yeah, and I was very much... I spent a great deal of time talking to Karl Popper because I found him perhaps the most interesting person there from my point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And my methodological philosophy is Popperian. It's his fundamental insight. That expressed in the title of one of his books, which goes something like refutation, the emphasis is on refutation, whether you can refute, and his dividing line between science and non-science is whether you generate empirically refutable, in principle, empirically refutable proposition. And I was interested in going back and trying to see whether I had derived my approach from that. And that's why I dug out of the files the earlier drafts of that methodology article and discovered that they preceded my going to Mont Pelerin.
So you just...
And Mont Pelerin was April 47.
You just... Then it was helpful to you to elucidate those ideas, to talk them over with him.
Sure.
But
oh, sure.
You had put them together.
Okay,
no, I'm just trying to get...
Absolutely.
That.
Yeah. But the fundamental approach predated that.
Right. The idea that a purely mathematical model can't be refuted. If you want to take a model to the data that you can refute, you have to bring something to it, something inductive, some generalization about
and
how the world
well,
works.
It's not that so much. It's not that so much. That if you do state a predictive statement, its validity depends on whether it's refuted. Not on whether it's the assumptions versus reputations idea. That was, see, what was key to the methodology article was that at that time, in 1945, 6, 7, there was a big argument and discussion going on in the economic literature about how you check and test the theory. And about the reality or unreality of assumptions. All of this derived from, I think it was Hall and Hitch, who went around and did a survey of businessmen and asked them, in order to see whether economic theory was valid, asked them, do you calculate marginal cost? Do you equate cost with how do you determine your prices and so on? They wrote articles and I think a book on the basis of this. And there was a good deal of discussion, you'll find in the economic literature of that time. I no longer remember that Machloop was involved. Half a dozen well-known economists.
I mean, today we don't think, we think economists, we think synonymously somebody who thinks of price determination in terms of marginal conditions. But in those days, there were institutionalists. The meaning of economist didn't have the same... today, in a sense, everybody accepts the marginal analysis of price determination.
Well, there were many institutionalists, and there was a great deal of objection, particularly, to mathematical economics.
Well, you were at Wisconsin, right, so you must have gotten some of that tradition from John Commons.
He was gone by the time I got there, but it was... Oh yeah, it was very live. And if you look back in the American Economic Review, for example, around 45, 46, 47, there was a lot of stuff in there about this argument. I have, I think, a footnote reference to it in the methodology article.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the essence of this was, well, to see whether a theory is valid, you go around, it has assumptions, and you go around and you test the assumptions. Marginal analysis assumes that people are rational. Well, go ask them if they're rational. It assumes that businessmen make calculations of marginal cost and equate price to marginal cost. Do they? Let's go and ask them. And my argument was that the assumptions are not what, it's utterly irrelevant what they say. What matters is whether they behave as if they're doing those things. And the only way you can test that is by seeing whether the predictions you make are refuted by the empirical evidence. And that's also the proposition that's at the center of Popper's philosophical, methodological approach.
Well, would you call Paul Douglas the first member of the Chicago School? His Cobb-Douglas production function explained the distribution of income through marginal conditions, yet it was embodied in an empirically testable... implications were the share of income...
Tavlis.
I've never met him, I just know of his work.
But he's written in recent years quite a number of articles that have gradually been squeezed down. One of them, I think, will be published by the JP shortly, in which he emphasizes, he brought to me, back to me, I really had hadn't been thinking in those terms, that Douglass was indeed very much an early member of the Chicago School in many ways, in monetary theory as well.
Oh, yes, he was a very strong quantity theorist.
Right,
and he challenged Wright Patman in 1952 on the quantity theory on exactly. And there's a wonderful...
But now you're taking him after he came to the Senate. But this is back in the 30s, early 30s. Or
right,
20s, really, late
right.
20s and 30s, when he was writing about business cycles. Aaron Director came to Chicago to work with Douglass. And Douglass and they wrote a book together, Douglass and Director, on unemployment, in which it's a straight quantity theory analysis of the source of recessions and depressions and of unemployment. And he was a very strong proponent of using monetary See, Tablet stresses a point I hadn't quite realized. Now, what was distinctive about the Chicago School in the 1930s in monetary analysis was that it stressed it emphasized the use of fiscal policy as a monetary mechanism, not as a Keynesian demand mechanism, but as a monetary mechanism in the sense that they believed that the way to get out of the Depression was to get more money in circulation. But that open market operations might not be successful because there was so little demand on the part of business for loans. And so they argued that the way to increase the quantity of money was to have government engage in deficit spending. And Douglass was among those who took that view.
So that's
Viner
the, relate,
well.
I mean, in a way, there's a connection there with the piece we just talked about that you wrote. Where you tie the deficit to money creation.
That's right.
But with
that's
some
right.
rule for balancing it.
Well, they also wanted a balance over time. There's no question. Those aspects are all in there. Tablet, as I say, the piece is coming out in the JP, I'm not sure when, by Tablet. But I'm sure he would be more than delighted to provide you with his piece on that if you're interested. I think he's done a very good job.
In 1933, nine Chicago professors sent a memo to Henry Wallace arguing that government should restore the level of wholesale prices and that the Fed should issue whatever money was needed to meet withdrawals from banks, and it was signed by Frank Knight, Lloyd Mintz, Schultz, Henry Simons.
They had sent a number of those earlier.
Aaron Director, Paul Douglass, and Albert Hart. When you were at Chicago, were there policy discussions? Did the professors include students in policy discussions? Would you have been aware of that memo at the time or not?
Well, yes, I would have been aware. But the reason I would have been aware is not necessarily an answer to your question. See, Aaron Director is Rose's, my wife's brother.
Right.
And she and I were going together already at that time when I was a student there. So I was in touch with Aaron, and through Aaron with Frank Knight. And so I knew, of course, at the time about all of these policy discussions.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any sense why Jacob Viner didn't sign the memo? Did he distance himself from that?
No, Jacob Viner was very much of the same school. No. I don't know why he didn't happen to sign that. He signed some of the earlier ones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he may have been in Washington. But, and he gave, first of all, he gave a series of talks in 1933. One of them was at the University of Minnesota on inflation, deflation, or reflation, something like that. And in a number of talks, Viner, and again, Tablet discusses this at length. And in a number of talks, Viner is very explicit that you need to, to what he calls reflate, you need to increase the quantity of money in order to get the economy moving.
At the time, Holbrook Working and Carl Snyder were publishing graphs showing the quantity of money per unit of output and the
who
price.
Who was other than Carl Snyder, you said?
Holbrook working.
Holbrook working,
Were you familiar with those at all when you did your work in the early 50s? Is that something that you
remember? I don't remember ever knowing anything about Holbrook working, but I'm sure we were familiar with the work of Carl Snyder, Snyder, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was at the New York Federal Reserve Bank.
Right.
And he was one of the few people in the system who during the 1930s, early 30s, was arguing for an increase in the quantity of money. He very much influenced, he was very much influenced by Benjamin Strong before Strong died. And then he in turn had a strong influence on George Harrison.
It wasn't vice versa. There are a lot of strong letters at the New York Fed, and I need to go there and read those sometime, but the influence didn't go the other way around from Fisher and Snyder to Strong as opposed to...
Oh, that's hard to say. I don't think it went... No. I don't doubt... See, I really can't answer that right now. I'd have to, you'd have to go back
they
and look
may have
at the...
just have been of the same temperament and corresponded. Yeah. But Strong did
Strong,
come out against the real bills doctrine, I think, in 1921.
Yeah. Strong was a very... You know, from very early on, he was right. He was very good.
Yeah.
And whether, how much he was influenced by Fisher, gee, I don't know. I wonder, there is a biography of Strong that was written by...
Right, but there's nothing in,
I haven't looked at it for years.
Chandler was a Keynesian when he wrote it, so he may have missed things that were relevant.
I don't recall that. That's a very interesting question. Because Fisher, of course, was always very, very active.
Mm-hmm.
He was always, one of his great activities was agitating for alcoholic prohibition. And he saw personally every candidate for the presidency from about 1916 or 14 or 12 on in order to promote the prohibition platform. But now on this issue, as you know, Strong started out as president of the Bank of the New York Bank. It's still existing. Bankers Trust.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
He was president of Bankers Trust. I don't know. I've never had looked into I read Chandler's biography and that's about all.
Yeah. Viner,
where he got the ideas is one thing. That he had those ideas very strongly is another. And I would be surprised if he didn't go from Strong to Snyder rather than the other way around. Obviously, Snyder may have reinforced it.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure it went from Snyder. Snyder was very influential with George Harrison once Harrison became president. But Harrison didn't have the same strong personality that Strong did. And moreover, as you know, some of the other bank presidents who had been very jealous of Strong's preeminence weren't going to let George Harrison take that place.
Let me come back to some of these other individuals. Through the early 50s, at least, forgetting about the 1960s, Viner remained a very strong quantity theorist. In fact, there are congressional hearings, I think, in 48 or 49, where he testifies along with Goldenweiser, and Viner argues that Congress should force the Fed to adopt a price level target. And a case for flexible exchange rates, that was in 1952. And that's full-blown Milton Friedman. That's full-blown quantity theory. There's not a word in that. There's not a word in there today that you would change. When you wrote did you still have contact with Viner? Had you read his theory of international trade?
Of course I had read his theory of international trade. But what was much more important from that point of view was his book on customs unions.
I'm sorry, I haven't read it.
No, the reason I say that is because the ideas about floating exchange rates, that article on flexible exchange rates,
mm-hmm.
really was derived from my experience in 1950 when I spent 3 months in Paris as a consultant to the
European Payments Union,
the Marshall Plan. It was the Marshall Plan Agency, whatever it was called, Office of Economic Cooperation or something, whatever it was called. It was the Marshall Plan Agency in Paris. And my assignment was to analyze the proposed coal and steel community, which was the predecessor to the common market. And it was in that connection. See, the question was whether the U.S. government should endorse the proposed Schuman plan, as it was, for an iron and steel community. And I argued at the time, in several memoranda I wrote, that the iron and steel community could be successful only if they had flexible exchange rates between the countries, because of the different monetary and price situations within the various countries and the changes that were going to come around. But it was not there was no willingness to accept it at all. The big issue at the moment was that Germany was out of alignment. I'd forgotten which way. And I proposed as a solution to the German problem that they close the exchange rate. I went to Frankfurt to talk with the German people. And that was horror of horrors. I was never going to consider that. But at any rate, that flexible exchange rate article was really based, had its origin in the memorandum I wrote in 1950 for the Marshall Plan Group. So by 1950, I'm sure my ideas on floating exchange rates were fully developed. Now, floating exchange rates, remember, they weren't original with me. Lloyd Mintz had always been a proponent of floating exchange rates for a long time.
And Canada had floated by then, so this was something that had been done, I think.
Well, when was Canada floating?
Well, it's mentioned in your article, so it had to have been by 1952.
Yeah, it had to be. And, well, you had had floating exchange rates during the interwar period as a matter of necessity.
The greenback relative to gold.
No. I mean between the First and the Second World War.
Oh, I see, between the Civil War.
You mean after 33, after the Great Depression.
Yeah.
When the gold standard broke down, you did have a period of floating exchange rates with all sorts of manipulations and attempt to control it, exchange control. So that, so far as that's concerned, I don't believe I was departing very far from what Lloyd Mintz, for example, would have favored and thought. But as I say, my own attention to it, my own concern, my own interest in it derived from that experience in Paris.
Was your main intellectual contact with Jacob Viner the year you had him for price theory in 32 or 33, and mostly in Washington, and you didn't see him that much?
I saw him very little in Washington. I saw him in Washington during the war, so.
But later on during your career, you didn't have much contact.
Very little. I remember visiting him once in Princeton, meeting in various places, and I wrote the obituary notice for him that appeared in the American Economic Review. They were anonymous at that time. I don't know whether they still are. And I had correspondence with him, though I no longer remember about what. But I had a much more intimate sort of personal relation with Frank Knight than I did with Jacob Viner.
In terms of the people you talked over with your distinction between Marshallian and Valrasian economics, in the foreword to that article, the Marshallian Demand Curve, you mention Arthur Burns, Aaron Director, H. Greg Lewis, George Stigler, and Jacob Viner. Did you consider them all by temperament Marshallians, or did you argue with them? Were they was what was your contact with Lewis at that time? Was he already at Chicago?
Was who?
H. Greg Lewis.
Oh yeah, Greg Lewis.
He was already.
Okay. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Well, he was there before I was.
Okay.
As on the faculty, he was a student.
That I didn't know.
And then
I knew that.
He became an assistant to Douglas, and then he became a faculty member.
That I just didn't
know.
So
Greg was at the. Oh yeah, Greg was there. One of the people I got to know. I really didn't get to know him until I got there in 46, because we didn't overlap as students. He was later than I was. But of those, let me see, Greg Lewis.
Well, Burns, Director, Lewis, Diggler, and Viner are the ones you mentioned.
I would say all of them would be more shadowy.
Mm-hmm.
See, George Stigler, as you know, was a co-student and a very, very close personal friends, and we were in continual contact by correspondence and otherwise, but he was not at Chicago.
He was at Columbia.
He was at Columbia. Well, he was first at Brown and then at Columbia. He and I were together in Minnesota. Yeah, as you know. You know the story. I got the job only because he was turned down.
Yeah.
As George says it is. I'm sure you've read that. But I had a great deal of correspondence with George. And I had probably more direct discussion of these various issues by correspondence with George than I did with any other one of those persons.
Mm-hmm. It seems like you followed complementary agenda, you know, a general agenda to show that the government should provide a framework and let the price system distribute resources, and you concentrated on the macroeconomic side, that the government should keep from shocking the economy, and he concentrated on the price theory side. Yeah. So to show that, in fact, the price system does allocate resources in an efficient way. But his genius was to bring empirical, as stated as a proposition, but to actually study government
intervention. Now, I think it's a matter of fact that the interaction between George and me was very fruitful for both of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think there's any doubt that we complemented.
Yeah.
One another. You know, George was a marvelous critic, a very, very clear, logical thinker, and of course a wonderful writer. I think next to Keynes, he's the most accomplished, real good accomplished stylist among the people you would regard as top economists.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I think about what carried on, the tradition that carried on in the Chicago School, the first thing that always comes to my mind is a sense of skepticism, an unwillingness to jump on bandwagons. That what I remember as a student hearing, you know, I'd hear the name Frank Knight, and the first thing that would come to mind is, what's new is not true, and what's true is not new. So
yeah.
It's that sense of skepticism.
Well, now, wait a minute. It's Viner who said that.
Oh, really? I just assumed that was Frank Knight.
Unless I am greatly mistaken, this can be checked, and I don't trust my memory.
No.
But I believe Viner gave his presidential address as president of the American Economic at a meeting of the American Economic
Association. The long run and the short run.
In New Orleans.
Yeah.
And I think the phrase is in there.
Okay, I can check it out.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But somehow or other, I've always associated that phrase with Viner, although it could have come from Knight. In terms of temperament, it could certainly have come from Knight.
Yeah.
But you raise a very interesting question. And that is, when did I make the shift from sort of a mixture of Keynesianism and modern Buddhism? Well, mostly Keynesianism, too back to pure quantity of money approach.
It was definitely completed by 52.
Right.
And
the fact that this, the flexible exchange piece really came in 50, 50s, if you're going to date them. Ideas, they go back to 50. Suggests that it must have been earlier than that.
Well, key dates must have been 1948 when you began the money workshop and you began work with NBER on the money series.
That's
and
right.
So it must have been some combination of looking at the income velocity of money over a long period of time and saying, hey, this is stable. Because you looked at that series when you were at the Treasury in a piece that Angel wrote predicting inflation, and your judgment at the time was that the series is not very stable. So it must have been going back, and it must have been in those two years.
I don't believe that that was it. I may have done that, but I don't believe that that would have, that was it.
When did you work on, remember the piece you wrote in the AER where you compared inflation in the Civil War and World War I, and you showed that the proportionate rise in the price level depend upon the changes in money, not the behavior of the deficit. When did you put those, that was a controlled experiment, comparing the deficit and money creation.
Yeah, that was
the first one that you...
That's right. That was the first one I...
Later on, 66, 68, but this was the first
and one. I think that one did have a good deal of influence on it. Much more, that would have been more important than any long-run velocity picture. When was that published?
52, I believe, in the AER.
Well, then I must have done it in 51. 50 or 51. It may well be that the agreement to undertake the monetary study for the National Bureau started me in really rereading about this. That may well be.
Do you remember when you went back and reread Fisher, or when you first...
I don't remember at all.
Okay.
I don't remember that at all. Now, I taught, in the first year or two I was at Chicago, first several years I was in Chicago, I taught an undergraduate course in money, in addition to teaching price theory at the undergraduate level. I taught 203, was it? No. What was the money for? 30. 230.
Do you have your notes from that time?
I may very well.
Oh, Gloria says they're kind of a mess, but you just kind of...
I may very well. If I do, they're almost surely in the archives.
At the Hoover Institute.
Actually, they're perfectly accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an index of the archives.
Just need to call one of the archivists. I
know. No, you just get Gloria.
Okay.
To show you the book, the index of the archives.
Okay.
Some from that you'll be able to find out for yourself.
There were monetary hearings at that time, in particular associated with the Federal Reserve Accord, the Patman hearings. Did you have any contact with Douglas at that time?
Oh, yes, sure. I testified before Douglas several times. He and I were always in agreement.
So that must have been an influence, because the
Well, was it, by that time, June, I was pretty well formed. I don't think so.
But the Korean War started in June of 1950, and the accord then was in March of 51. So that summer of 1950 is when the Fed fought it out with the Treasury over pegging the long-term bond rate. So that was before...
But I don't... The hearings... See... I'd have to look up in my bibliography.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe that the hearings were in 51 or 52, not in 50, at which I testified.
Yeah, 52, I think. I've got them. I've got 52.
There were two sets 52. Of hearings.
Yes.
One of them, Patman was the chairman.
Right.
The Joint Economic Committee.
Right.
And the other set, Paul Douglas was the chairman of the Joint Economic Committee. See, I looked back at this recently in a different connection. In connection with the with a proposal to have a purchasing power security.
Yes.
And in the initial hearings, on growth, stability, and something else. They sent out a questionnaire or asked questions of a large number of people. They reported in one of these hearing bodies, which also I happen to have at the office if you want to look at it. And they asked the question, among the questions they asked economists, this
was a special circulation
of economists.
Yes.
And among the questions they asked economists was, are you in favor of a purchasing power security? And I think there were some 20 economists who said yes, 17 who said no. Of the 17, three or four were from life insurance companies, and you can understand why they didn't like the argument. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing to me was, I'm going back over it, the a little while ago in the Wall Street Journal, Kaufman had an article. Every argument he had in there was a duplicate of one of the arguments that was made in 1952 or whenever it was against that proposal. And on another occasion, I remember testifying before Douglas in which this issue came up. And he somehow or other, he wanted to know what I thought of it. And he agreed that it was a desirable thing, and he wondered why the Treasury wouldn't do it. And he asked the Treasury to check into a purchasing power security and provide him with a memorandum on it. And they came out with a memorandum against it. I don't remember where it is.
Yeah.
But, you know, what's absurd to me is the way in which this proposal has been greeted, as if it's something brand new, as if it had never been suggested before. When it goes back to the 14th or 15th century,
right?
Who was it? That famous Oxford dean,
right? Yeah,
who had to intervene on the question of what a scholarship meant, whether it should be in real terms or nominal terms.
Well, sure, the tabular standard and the whole literature. There's not a very good documentary history of the Accord from the congressional side. Do you know, was Douglas a key mover on the congressional side, the key mover? Do you know much about the story from that? Because there's some Fed minutes, and I have interviewed, there's still some New York Fed and some board people alive, Ralph Leach, for example, and I have interviewed them and recorded, and I've gotten a lot of interesting information. There's very little on the congressional side, but you don't have any inside of kind of discussions with Douglas.
No, I don't.
Okay.
No. I don't recall. 1950. I'm sorry, I have nothing.
I'm wondering, they might...
intellectual ability and capacity. He was really a very, very able person. But temperamentally, he never really got the respect of the Senate. He was too emotional, when he first went in, everybody had great ideas of how he was going to become a sort of a really major figure. And he never did.
Well, he felt very strongly about certain liberal causes, so he would have been, for the 1950s, he would have been out of step with the temperament in the Senate and in the House, I think, in terms of his kind of liberal, what we say today is liberal concerns. There's a wonderful story that's repeated a lot of places where Secretary of Snyder is testifying and Douglas is trying to explain to him why money growth causes inflation, and Snyder's not getting it. So Douglas takes a pitcher of water and starts pouring it into the glass of water, and until it just overflows, and he says, that's what happens to the price level when you keep money growth going. It just keeps overflowing, and the water's going everywhere.
There's a story when he was teaching, he used to illustrate the principle of diminishing utility by bringing a bag of oranges into the room and throwing them out.